If you have ever attended a large-scale UU event like General Assembly, you've probably seen one of those T-shirts that has famous Unitarian Universalists emblazoned across the front. Usually they start out with presidents like John or John Quincy Adams. They add Thomas Jefferson, even though he was an Anglican, not a Unitarian. He said he had to be content to be a Unitarian by himself, there being no church nearby. And we include William Howard Taft, the president of our country back in the early part of the 20th century. And then there are the influential ministers that shaped our religious movement: Theodore Parker, Ralph Waldo Emerson, William Ellery Channing. There are the women's social reformers: Susan B. Anthony, a Unitarian from Rochester, New York; Clara Barton, who grew up in the Universalist Church in eastern Massachusetts. And going back even further to the 16th century and the Protestant Reformation, we remember and print the names of people like Francis David, the Transylvanian reformer, who introduced Unitarian ideas to the Principality of Transylvania in the 1560s. And especially on this morning of October 23rd, I stopped to think that just 4 days from now, on October 27th, is the anniversary of the burning alive of Michael Servetus, our martyr who was executed for his ideas challenging the doctrine of the Trinity. There are many more I could name, but my point is that it seems like a lot of Unitarian Universalists feel good about themselves and our sometimes misunderstood liberal religious movement by bolstering their self-esteem with the display of names of our past heroes and saints on church websites or across the chests of our T-shirts. Now, as an historian, I'm all for looking at the past to inform how we understand our identity. But if we focus only on the heroes, the saints, those whom we admire, we're apt to distort our own history and delude ourselves into thinking that our UU tradition is nothing but just an unbroken stream of glory and freedom and progressive idealism. Sorry to tell you the bad news. It's just not so. In this month of October, when our worship theme has been ancestors and ghosts, I started to think about some of the skeletons in our UU family closet. A few years ago, my ministerial colleague Arvid Straube began compiling a list of embarrassing names from our UU past. A list, he said, that should go on the backside of those T-shirts so that we would present a fair and balanced account of our history. So the first thing I want to do this morning is do a little bit of setting the record straight. Who is it that we are embarrassed about today? Who is it that gives our UU history a bad name? Well, there are some who we remember just for one or two specific patterns of activity. I could mention Horatio Alger, well known to a lot of you as a writer, but many of you don't know that he started out his professional life as a Unitarian minister until, sad to say, he was defrocked for pedophilia. There's Neville Chamberlain, the British Unitarian, who infamously went to Berlin in 1938 to sign a pact with Hitler that he thought would prevent war, and we know how that turned out. There's the architect, the main architect of the Titanic, who was a Unitarian, and we know how that turned out. There was Lydia Pinkham, a Universalist woman who was a manufacturer, inventor, and salesperson of snake oil back in the late 19th century. One of my favorites comes from the 1970s. Some of you will remember that early in the 1970s, the Supreme Court seat held by Abe Fortas fell vacant, and Richard Nixon nominated a man named G. Harold Carswell to fill the seat. It caused a great uproar and argument in the Senate. He was not approved and was charged with being mediocre. Roman Hruska, a U.S. senator from Nebraska and a member of Omaha's First Unitarian Church, made headlines when he remarked, "Even if he were a little mediocre, there are a lot of mediocre judges and people and lawyers. They're entitled to a little representation, aren't they?" Well, these are some of the people from our past who don't exactly shine like stars. And if that were the worst of it, maybe we could be a little more relaxed. But then there were those who were, by our modern standards, I think truly evil, and actively fought for ideas and values that we look back with, at least with embarrassment, if not horror, today. The Pullman family were universalists. They even have a church named after them in upstate New York. But you remember, perhaps, that George Pullman, of railroad fame, was responsible for the worst labor massacre in American history as he opposed the labor union's strike against his railroads. And when we look at the slavery issue of the 19th century, it's here that I think we have to confront some of the worst racism in our religious past. There's John C. Calhoun, one of the founders of All Souls Unitarian Church in Washington, D.C. He contributed generously to the cost of the church's construction, attended services there. He was a vice president, secretary of war and defense and state, a representative from South Carolina in both the House and the Senate, and was known as the cast iron man in his defense of slavery year after year, decade after decade. We should remember that large numbers of northern merchants in eastern Massachusetts, in the Boston area, strong pillars of their various Unitarian churches, whose wealth depended on the slavery and the plantation structure of the southern states, and they resisted abolition efforts year after year, decade after decade. But it's not just back in the 1840s and 50s. The newspaper editor in Tulsa, Oklahoma, who fomented a riot against Tulsa's black community in 1919, was a prominent minister of that, a prominent member of that city's All Souls Unitarian Church. An ironic name that we might well do more accurately to call Some Souls Unitarian Church. Examples like these remind us that our history is not as spotless as we might wish it to be. We need to remember that we ourselves are and have been imperfect in many ways. Thomas Jefferson, whom we so love to admire and claim as one of our own, was, as you know, a slaveholder who, during his lifetime, could not bring himself, and even after his death, could not bring himself to free his slaves. He was a white supremacist. Theodore Parker, the great Unitarian preacher of the 1840s and 50s, despite his dangerous and dedicated work for the Underground Railroad, helping slaves to flee north to Canada for their freedom, believed nevertheless in white superiority. So my question is, what do we do with these skeletons in the UU closet? What do such people tell us about who we have been, who we may still be, and who we are on our way to becoming? Does their presence in our collective closet still today have something to say about who we are? Are they just isolated outliers, our own version of backsliders? Or do they represent a kind of shadow side of our religious tradition that still may have life within us today and that we should pay attention to, come to some better understanding of, in order to get a fuller picture of ourselves? I think the whole struggle for and against slavery holds one of the most important keys to answering these kinds of questions. The systemic and unconscious racism that still infects and pervades and festers within our society and its moral fabric, and me and you unconsciously, may be the best lens for us to look through to discern some of the complicated relationship between saints and sinners in our history. And it just doesn't touch us only collectively as a religious tradition, but individually in our families. My ministerial colleague, Ken Collier, in doing some genealogical work about 10 or 15 years ago, discovered the names of some of his ancestors who had been slaveholders. He was so shaken by this and so guilt-ridden that he spent a large amount of time and his own money to track down the descendants of the African Americans whose ancestors, his own ancestors, had owned. He contacted them, he visited them, and tried in whatever way he could to make amends for what his own ancestors had done. Mark Morrison Reed, many of you know Mark as one of the probably the leading African American minister in our Unitarian Universalist movement, discovered a few years ago that some of his own ancestors had themselves been slave owners. Slave owning was not confined only to whites. There were black slave owners. And he has talked with me about how he's wrestled with that skeleton in his family closet. And so we live with all kinds of ghosts and skeletons in our family histories, in our congregations, in our local communities, in our national history with all of its social evils, in the story of human civilization across this planet. Now, we might be tempted to forgive public figures like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson as just prisoners of their own time and era, simply followers of the attitudes and values that prevailed in the culture that they grew up in. Jefferson, after all, was in many ways a visionary and a man worthy of honor. And yet, still we can and should blame them. We can blame them because just as surely as they represented and followed the conventional values of their day, they had contemporaries whom we remember and honor for breaking out of those values, for breaking away, for living outside the box, the box of moral responsibility. I think of, for example, the Universalist pioneer in Pennsylvania, George de Benneville, who brought Universalism over from Europe in the early 1740s. And in the 50s, he foresaw, quote, "The spirit of love will be intensified to godly proportions when reciprocal love exists between the entire human race, based upon mutual respect for the differences in color, language, and worship." An anti-racist statement remarkable for 1750, I think. I've recently been reminded of the Quaker John Woolman by the Quaker theologian Parker Palmer in this book, Healing the Heart of Democracy. Parker reminds us of Woolman's commitment in the face of fellow Quakers who owned slaves, that he would refuse. Woolman wore white clothes, undyed, because dye was a product of slave labor. At meals, he would fast rather than eat food set before him by his hosts if he knew that it had been prepared or served, perhaps even grown by slaves. Needless to say, he had a lot of hungry evenings. Woolman paid, and his family paid, a great price for their determination to stand against slavery. But he's an example to us of the fact that there were people in that era who were willing not simply to support slavery because it was the thing that everybody did. And Parker Palmer describes an important aspect of Woolman's brokenheartedness over the fact of slavery. Palmer says that his story allows us to distinguish between two kinds of heartbreak. First is the conventional image of a heart exploded into 1,000 shards. Some of us try to pick up the pieces and put our lives back together. Some fall into long-term despair. Some take grim satisfaction in the injury the heart's explosion inflicts on our enemies. This kind of broken heart is an unresolved wound that keeps on wounding ourselves and others. But, says Parker, there is an alternative image for a broken heart, exemplified by Woolman. When the heart is supple, it can be broken open into a greater capacity to hold our own and the world's pain. It happens every day when we hold our suffering in a way that opens us to greater compassion. Heartbreak becomes a source of healing, deepening our empathy for others who suffer and extending our ability to reach out to them. This kind of tension holding, says Parker, can plant the seeds of justice and peace, as Woolman and other exemplars of nonviolence have shown time and again. And so I think moral bravery that exemplifies an ability to hold tensions, conflicting tensions, and live with them until that holding can move toward resolution is maybe one of the most important personality characteristics of people who we may want to call saints. We in our own congregation here have an example of that. Many of you remember Bernie Loomer, who was a member here back in the 1970s and 1980s, a UU theologian who invented or applied the word size to describe that personality characteristic of one who can hold and embrace a large spectrum of compatible contrasts without losing his or her own integrity. A person of size was Loomer's way of making the same point that Parker Palmer does about having a supple heart. When we here speak every Sunday morning, as we do in our church's mission statement, of inspiring spiritual growth and encouraging lives of integrity, it's this prophetic vision of growing ever more open hearts, in Parker Palmer's terms, or of becoming people of large and generous size, in Bernie Loomer's terms. That's what we're talking about. But the notion of size and open-heartedness applies to the church as a whole, not just to us as individuals. If the church is truly to stand as a countercultural institution devoted to personal and social transformation, as I believe it is, then we have to look honestly at ourselves and our history. Because there are cycles of history. Ralph Waldo Emerson is a good example. When he proclaimed a doctrine of self-reliance and individualism in the 1830s, it blew like fresh air through the stuffy atmosphere of New England. But that same individualism today has run amok in our society. And what we desperately need is community. So there are cycles of history, and the evils of one era may be the blessings of another. The times, they are changing, as our most recent literature Nobel laureate taught us 50 years ago. The church's prophetic role for individuals and for society, prophetic role, is to stand aside from the conventionality of society and help us keep our eyes on the prize, to help us hold diversity and difference in creative tension, holding on to that tension until we can hear each other's voices and stories more clearly, more deeply, and create deeper harmony out of previous chaos. How do we see ourselves right now, or can we see ourselves in the mirror of time? As saints, as sinners, as skeletons in the closet of history past, or heroes in the building of a new history? And when we look into that mirror, can we truly see ourselves as we are, or do we see ourselves as we wish we were? Oh, wad some power the gifty gie us to see ourselves as ithers see us, wrote the Scots poet Robert Burns. And how do others see us, and how will they see us from the vantage of a future that we have yet to achieve? Jonas Salk, the inventor of the polio vaccine, once said that our greatest responsibility is to be good ancestors. Will we be good ancestors? Will we here in this congregation and in UU churches around the country, as mostly people of privilege, be looked back upon by future generations as sinners who grew fat off of that privilege, or as saints who saw the evil and suffering that grew out of obscenely unequal privilege? Or will we be seen to have used our own advantages to work for a world of greater justice, a world not of dominion and oppression, as characterizes so much of our world at present, but one of mutuality and compassion? That's the question we have to ask ourselves every day, every week, year after year, as individuals and a church. It's a question, it's the question, I think, that's being fought out in the bitterness of this season's presidential campaign. The skeletons in our UU closet remind us how easy it is for our consciences and our ideals of justice to succumb to what is merely comfortable, to what business as usual tells us, that it's the way it's always been, it's just human nature, what can one person do? The list of excuses can go on and on. We are imperfect creatures in an imperfect universe. And while we may be tempted to divide the human race up into saints and sinners, a more accurate view is what Alexander Solzhenitsyn wrote in the Gulag Archipelago, that the dividing line between good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. And who, asked Solzhenitsyn, is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart? I think the answer is that we have to look honestly at all the pieces of our hearts, the good and the bad, and work to enlarge that side of our heart that is already standing on the side of love, to become ever more big-hearted and open-hearted, increasing our capacity to hold difference in creative tension. This is our universalist heritage speaking here. It speaks of inclusion, of mutuality, of a world in which the unifying power of love operates ever more deeply and constantly in our lives. Those who have lived in that way or have approached living in that way are our most genuine saints, worthy of our honor. So I don't think we're wrong, as poet Stephen Spender wrote in our reading before the sermon, that we should think continually of those who left the vivid air signed with their honor. It is they of whom we sing in our closing hymn. It is they who inspire us to our best selves by showing us what is possible to the human spirit, by showing us that a prophetic church encouraging people to live morally, visionary, and prophetic lives is not a pipe dream, is not impossible, but a call to action, a call to bravery, a call to a better future. The challenge is ours. May we accept it so that we can take steps towards sainthood and that our lives may shine like stars. So be it. Amen.